Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the LAMB. The LAMB is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the LAMB community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the LAMB and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 566 of the Lambcast. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day and the Strother Martin Film Project. In today's show, the music is all that matters. Nothing but the music. Okay, that, and the dancing, and the cinematography, and the editing, and the costumes, and the special effects. Classic films have been occasional guests on the Lambcast. This year we had Rebecca and the Manchurian Candidate featured on the show. Lucky for us, it's time to dip into that vast vat of films that came out before most of us were born. And this week, we've stuck in our thumbs and pulled out a plum. January's movie of the month is the 1948 classic The Red Shoes. Joining us for today's discussion are a corps of dancers the world will soon know. Pirouetting on center stage from the Asian Cinema Film Club, Stephen Palmer. Welcome, Stephen.
Well, thank you for having me, although I have to warn you, I've got two left feet.
Well, we'll try not to trip over you and try not to let you trip us up either.
All right.
You can't alter human nature, no. I think you can do even better than that. You can ignore it. But someone you can't ignore, one of the critical movie critics, Lisa Leahy.
That is the best description. I love that so much because I am very much not a dancer. So I love that you just can't ignore me no matter what you do.
There you go. And not even the best magician in the world can produce a rabbit out of a hat if there's not already a rabbit in the hat. Now a man who always makes sure the rabbit is there, from Forgotten Films, Todd Liebenow.
I'm glad you picked that quote for me, Richard, and I knew you'd pick that one at some point given your family history and the art of magic.
So. There you go. And I think they're giving away secrets, damn it.
I guess you could put it that way. Sure. The limited knowledge I have of a few tricks, I knew, the first lesson I was taught was you do not discuss it no matter what.
Ever. So.
Don't
ever
give away the secrets. And next, he doesn't know why he must, but he has to. Blog. From Deep Focus Review, Brian Eggert.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. It's much more disheartening to have to steal than to be stolen from, Well, if I was going to steal from anyone on the show, it would be from Meg Hyland of Megan's Movie Alphabet.
Thanks for having me, and I love that you picked that quote for me. I just want to say thanks so much for anyone who voted for The Red Shoes, and I've suggested it a couple of times now, so I'm glad I didn't have to go into double digits for the amount of times I suggested it.
Well, I was going to say, Meg's put forward The Red Shoes as Movie of the Month several times, vowing to do so until it was victorious. Well, let's find out if it won because people want to hear about it or if they simply wanted to be done with it. I'm gonna turn the reins of our discussion over to the film's champion, Meg Hyland.
Hello. Well, thank you so much for letting me be the gracious host of this episode. And I suppose the way to start this episode off is to explain what exactly is The Red Shoes. The Red Shoes, made in the late 1940s by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger of Powell and Pressburger fame. The Red Shoes is set within the ballet dance company Lermontov, and it follows aspiring dancer Victoria Page and aspiring composer Julian Craster as they both rise within the ranks within the dance company. Of course, as things do in these old Hollywood movies, that love starts to come into the way of creative freedom, and the perilous director of the ballet, Boris Lermontov, decides, well, you can't have it both ways. It's either love or creativity. So which one will out in the end? You'll have to watch it to see. So first impressions. I want to hear if anyone's seen this for the first time or if you've got a history with the movie. So let's go around the table.
It's first time for me.
First time for me as well.
Yeah,
this is the second time I've seen it, but the first time was 40 years ago, 50 years ago, so I barely remembered it.
This is actually one of my
first time for me.
This is one of my favorite movies of all time. Actually, it's probably a top three favorite for me. I've seen it, more than 10 times.
I absolutely love this film. I personally came to it in around 2009, just after Martin Scorsese helped with the restoration. It was the Criterion Collection put out the restored version in 2010 after it premiered at Cannes in 2009 with the restoration. Sorry, just to say that, like, there was decades there in like the 50s and 60s where this movie, no one could find it, no one could see it, no one could screen it. The original celluloid had mold covering it, like marks and scratches. It took so much effort to actually get this movie to even exist today, and I'm just so grateful that it does. And the first time I saw it, I literally was just gobsmacked by the beauty of the Technicolor, the dancing, the cinematography, the like old school acting, and just like the idea that the plot is literally like creativity, passion, and love, like which one wins out and which do you have to sacrifice. And I adore it. So the people who, it's the first time watching it, what was your first impression of it? Please tell me.
Well, like I said, I'm not a dancer at all, but I am somewhat becoming more and more enamored with ballet and just seeing the mastery of it. I had a student who graduated recently who was part of the ballet here in where I live in Rhode Island, and I would go see her perform. And it was just, it's miraculous to watch what people can do and how graceful everyone is and just how strong they are. And to see this movie, I was very, very happy to see how much of it really did center. I wasn't sure going in if it was a movie about ballet or a sort of a ballet that was put on film, if you understand what I mean. And I was very happy to see that a lot of it was ballet put on film. Because that's really what I was hoping for. I'm the kind of person where I don't watch trailers, I don't read about things before I go into movies, so I went into this as cold as possible. And I just loved everything about it. I just thought it was absolutely masterful and gorgeous to look at.
Yeah, well, I'll echo a lot of those sentiments as well. It was my first time watch, and I thank you again for putting it forward. I always love when the classic films do come on there, and you know, we get an excuse to dig into our shame list, so to speak. You know, this is one that I probably should have seen by now, but hadn't. I mean, the film is gorgeous to look at. I'm sure we'll dig into that more. And, you know, I'm sure we'll probably devote a whole section of discussion to that 17-minute or so segment that comes in the middle of the film that is just breathtaking. But I was really struck by how this movie reminded me a lot of kind of classic Recode era musicals, kind of the backstage musical, as it's called often, you know, the things like Footlight Parade or 42nd Street, where it's got a lot of those same type of elements of, you know, so these up and coming people trying to make a name for themselves in the theater. And, you know, they have the challenges of that along with the challenges of life and love and all those things and how those things kind of butt heads. And then, of course, you know, those films also are peppered with various musical moments. You know, as I watched this, I thought, do we call this a musical? I mean, you could, I suppose, in some ways call it a musical, but it's not really. But it's got a lot of those elements of those pre-code backstage musicals that I love, kind of brought into a different kind of framework and, you know, elevated to something different. But, you know, it's, I still got a lot of the things about those films that I loved so much. So I was struck how it was just such a different take on that style of story that is just really engrossing.
It's a musical without any singing, just the dancing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like I said, I have a vague memory of seeing the film many years ago, and I remembered that the colors popped like crazy. But I remember the story of the shoes and how basically the ballerina dances herself to death, and that's not exactly the way it happens. It happens in the ballet that they have in the film, but in the movie the ending is a little bit different, but not that much different. We got to be careful about spoilers here, so we'll wait a little while to talk about that. Talking about all the things that are so. Old classic movies have a different sensibility about how they present things, and I was just astonished about all of the talking going on in the audience in that opening segment during the ballet. You know, people are speaking to each other as the ballet is being performed, and I've been to performances of classical music and even ballet, and that doesn't seem like it goes on very much. Now, I know a whole group of those people in the audience were supposed to be students of the composer of the film, and so they were enthusiastic, but I also thought it was kind of interesting how there's a clash between the people who are there for the dance and the people who are there for the music, and I thought that that was going to be a part of the story. Turns out that doesn't really have much to do with the story. The cribbing, the plagiarism, that also doesn't have anything to do with the story, except that it gets one of our protagonists into the ballet company. And outside of that, that whole opening section was just kind of odd, except that it introduces us to the notion that this is the environment that we're going to be watching for the next couple of hours.
I would slightly disagree. I think the kind of the scene at the beginning, the students rushing to get their seats, I think that's like it brings together Julian Krasker, the composer, and Victoria Page, the kind of dichotomy of what is in the ballet Lermontov. That is it all about the music or is it about the dance? Whose timing is off? I think it's like the two coexist in the world together and like they can't exist without each other. And I think because like even Krasner's character says later on when he's having that argument with Lermontov that like, oh, people would say that the ballet is rather a second-rate form of expression when he's talking about his music and the ballet. And it's, I feel like it's kind of more about finding that the music and the dance are as important as each other. And especially in the case of this movie, like the two of them rank as important as each other in my mind.
Yeah, I think there's actually kind of an idea behind the movie that all art is coming together in one way or another. So Paul and Pressburger were really fascinated with this idea of ballet, music, and melodrama coming together to form a new kind of cinema. And that's sort of what you're seeing happen in the ballet. You're seeing, you know, dance, music, and production design and storytelling all coming together. So all these various forms of art coming together. And that sort of works its way through the drama in that Krasner and Vicky are falling in love. And it kind of reminded me of this time of La La Land in a way, in that they're both, you know, compelled to their art. But if they truly want to commit to their art, they can't, you know, they can't be in love. So it's either love or art. And so all these people are making sacrifices from all different walks of artistic backgrounds to create something, you know, that kind of coalesces into something magical or passionate.
Well, I definitely think everybody's got passion in the film for one thing or the other, but it seems to me like it's inevitable that the two things have to go together. The art form of ballet doesn't mean anything without the music, and the music is what inspires the dancing. So the notion that they're in conflict with one another, I know that comes up a couple of times in the film, but it always felt to me like it was one of those things that is forced a little bit on to the characters, similar to the having to choose between love and your passion. I think that's, you know, it's an artistic contrivance, and it's one that I'm perfectly willing to accept. I just thought it was a little strange that the way we're being introduced to it is in the balcony of that opening section.
I thought that section was rushed. I actually struggled a little bit to keep up with what was going on, although I do want to throw out a quick, I loved how cute it was when they all cheered for the professor.
Yes.
I don't know what it might just be because I'm a teacher myself, but I thought that was such a riot, like all these crazy kids up in the balcony yelling for their professor when he shows up. I just thought that I didn't think he appreciated enough either. I'm like, why isn't he like enjoying this more? But
he feels guilty.
Because they're going to find out that he's ripped them off.
Well, there's that too. Now that you mention it, you're absolutely right, because I didn't think of that later. But I don't know. I thought that whole sequence, I had trouble with the timeline occasionally. And there were points where I just kind of brushed it off, went, oh, okay, I'm not going to worry about that. But the amount of time that passes between that first ballet where we see them in the balcony, when Krasner goes to meet Lermontov, where Vicky shows up and she's, you know, sort of brushed off and she has to kind of find her way on stage, and then she gets brushed off. And then when she becomes you know, the she becomes part of the company. I don't know. I was struggling with the editing there because it seemed to jump around, and I couldn't tell if it was a day, a week, a month, or what.
But there's a lot of that in the film, isn't there? There's a lot of things that seem to happen off camera. The biggest one would be Vicky and Krasner even falling in love.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, good point.
They have a little moment over lunch and a few chats, and then suddenly they're the talk of the gang, of the production, that they're in love, and Lermontov has never heard of it. And there's a lot of these things which seem to happen, like almost as if the company is happening in one world and everybody else's lives are happening somewhere else off camera.
I think the editing, yes, it's a bit. It seems to jump from day to month to week, day to week to month. But if you read into the dialogue, it's all there, and especially with the use of like signage and graphics to show you what's going to be happening next. Like the amount of times that it's like, oh, it's like the poster for the movie. It's the beginning of the movie, and then it's like all the signs for like the baskets of going on the train of like, oh, we're going to Monte Carlo, and then it's more posters for going to like Paris and wherever. But I find like just coming back to the first scene, like the entire prologue, you're starting from the audience who are ready to watch a piece of art, and then you're getting closer and closer into the world. You're going more and more backstage during that. You start with the audience with Craster, and then you see Vicky from the high up boxes, and then you see the owners of the ballet, and then you go into it, and it's Sergei, the production designer, arguing that his door is being broken. Oh no, that's later on. He's arguing about the foreground, and then the dancers getting ready. So like the more and more you're like being led into this world, and I think that's really what I love about this movie.
And, just, like, and you see so it from different, you see it from all different kinds of angles as well. You see bits of it from down inside the orchestra pit. You see bits of it from the side. You're looking at people around. You know that not did you never see never in this film do you see the ballet sort of face on.
No.
As if it was being staged. Right. It's always off to the side. It's always through some interesting view, usually from someone else. Even the section later on where we sort of see the interpretation of the ballet, that's nothing like you'd watch a ballet, right. And there's aspects like you wouldn't even be able to see in the shoemaker's shop if that really was part of the stage. Yeah, if that really was part of the of it. So it's really interesting how Powell uses different viewpoints to show us something which normally would be very stagey.
And we never really get a set point of view, you know, to take that and go a little further into the narrative. We don't really have, I mean, we sort of do, I guess, if you're going to look at it more traditionally, but from a narratology point of view, we have a number of different protagonists here. You know, Lermontov is sort of situated as the antagonist. He's kind of the bad guy pushing it. But you could argue, you know, somebody who is in his position and needs his business to succeed and his passion is his dancers. You could argue that he is in a number of different positions where he has to push the mark. And, you know, you could take Julian as a protagonist. You could take Vicky as a protagonist. And I love the way this switches off, showing us who is dealing with what at what particular time.
And they all have their failings. They all have elements of brilliance in their characters and what they're contributing to the story and to the ballet, but they also have, you know, blind spots about one another, about the show, and about themselves. And I like that continues to be a part of the story, that you know, that Julian is getting the orchestra together ahead of time to rehearse and practice a tune that is probably not going to be on the next performances, and he's doing it on the company's dime.
And he doesn't realize he has to pay all the people he's brought in. He just thinks that they just come in for the love of it.
There you go.
No. I think a lot of it is about like how like these kind of creative pursuits, they are passions for these people, but they're realistically, they're also jobs, and like they like that pay the bills. And like, I love that section when Craster is coming in for his meeting and he's backstage trying to figure out who's in charge. And I think that's a big point when you were saying about that you could take anyone as the protagonist when you're behind stage and they're trying to find out who is in charge. Everyone thinks that they're in charge. Everyone thinks that their role is the most important.
Was that backstage kind of chaos, you know? that chaos that goes on backstage is you know, something that really comes through in that. And that's something that, you know, you're talking about how this shows, you know, what's going on, the full production of things, both front stage and backstage, from different angles and different characters' point of views. And that's something that's always been something that has resonated with me, you know, watching these type of movies, you know, again, referenced those earlier musicals, even going up. And Richard, I'm sorry, but I got to do it. You know, who believed I'd bring in the Muppet Show talking about the red shoes?
Yeah. But
it's that kind of feel where, you know, you're not seeing what the audience sees. You're seeing all of the other bits of chaos that go around. And that's part of what gives that program its charm for me. So, you know, this is a very different form of that, but it is kind of still the same vibe.
I love that you just brought the Muppet Show top 10 for you.
Does that make Kermit Boris and Miss Piggy Vicky?
I don't know. I mean, because
I think Vicky, I think Piggy is Boris.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, how, you know, as you were talking about the different roles that the different people play in this, and I'm going, well, do we paint the director as a villain in this or not? You know, I think there's some moments where by the end of the movie, I'm going, well, is he Satan? I mean, what's going on here?
Yeah. I think there is an element of that.
A monster many times.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted. Go on.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I think there is definitely an element of him being, you know, when Vicky's on stage and, you know, in the middle of the height of her performance, the ballet of the red shoes, she, you know, sees the shoemaker, the sort of, you know, demon shoemaker as Lermontov is one point, and he's definitely like that. And I think there's a good association there to be made with a film director, a certain type of film director. He actually reminded me of Hitchcock, in that, you know, Hitchcock was obsessed with his stars. He didn't want his leading ladies to, you know, have relationships, have children. He'd get mad at them when they'd get married or have, you know, get pregnant or something like that. And he would punish them. And he's, you know, Lermontov's doing the same thing here. And it's a really fascinating look from a director like Powell, who's very obsessed with having control and just being overseeing every detail. And then also making that commentary about Lermontov.
Well, and that's kind of the studio system as well. I mean, that was, you know, so prevalent in this era. So, yeah.
But it's also got a touch of Dorian Gray to it, if you're familiar with the novel, that like when Dorian falls in love with the actress, and like when she's on stage, she thinks she's really falling in love every time, which is why he thinks her performance is so electric. But once she experiences what she thinks is true love, it's lackluster ever since. And then he just discards her. And I feel like that's the kind of like mentality that Lermontov possesses in this, that like, unless you are like fully committed to this, you have part of your life is somewhere else, you will never truly be the best that there can be.
Yeah, well, life is unimportant.
Exactly. Life rushes by, love rushes by, but the twos dance on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he calls...
There is a suggestion, isn't there, that this isn't the first time he's, you know, he's quite happy to cut people off and bring new people in, and that maybe he's obsessed over ballerinas before, until they say they're going to get married, and then they disappear.
And then deliberately wants to make them jealous, you know, and try to lure them back.
Yeah, he calls you know, romance adolescent nonsense at one point, and he he does that very thing with his leading. His first leading dancer that we see, the French dancer who
Irina,
right, who goes off to get married, and he, you know, just walks out of the room basically
he basically finds everything that is not his production to be meaningless. He initially rejects the idea of going to the party after that first ballet. When he's there, he certainly doesn't want to be auditioned for at the party, which is perfectly understandable. He's indifferent to his cast. They were all amazed that he shows up to the birthday party later on. It's as if their social lives mean nothing to him. No relationship matters except the one that's in front of him at that particular moment that's related to his job, his creative process, to the company that he's dealing with. And he has no exterior life.
apart from he does have a family as well, because he has that group of sort of his leaders,
right?
You know, where they do the whole Waltons thing every night. Good night, Jim Bob. Yeah, good night. and there are people there that he trusts absolutely, who I guess you could call his family, and he's like the patriarch of that family, and they're really worried about telling him about Vicky and Julian's relationship, because they know he won't get it. But he does have, you know, he's not quite often you find these characters are alone, aren't they? You know, they're like Charles Foster Kane or something like that. You know, he's not like that. He has this very close knit group who are very honest with each other.
Yeah, but they are not personally close. I remember that scene where he's having breakfast, and he has the most elaborate breakfast you can imagine for an individual, being served to him by a valet or butler, and he's in his dressing gown.
Obviously, you haven't had breakfast in London, my friend.
I have. I have seen those. I did have that once, you know, as a matter of fact.
I have not. I'm getting on a plane immediately.
Oh, yes.
I see so much of Phantom Thread, the Welsh rarebit order in the morning. I was like, my God, this breakfast is so elaborate. And why is he putting that much sugar inside a melon, of all things?
I had the same thought. Like, do I not know what that is, maybe?
Well, he apparently has a sweet tooth. Did you see the way he put the sugar in his coffee? He basically dips the cube in and then pops it in his mouth like it's candy.
Yeah, I love that little detail.
What was Vicky putting into her orange juice? Later on, she spoons like bicarbonate of soda or something in it. I'm just like, what? You know, when she's having the lunch. It's like...
Yeah, I saw that as well. Yeah, I didn't know what that was.
I wondered though, was it orange juice, or could it have been egg yolks, like a kind of protein kind of breakfast?
Oh, yeah, because 10 minutes earlier, he told her not to have a glass of water because it would affect her breathing.
Yeah.
And then she's putting egg yolks and sugar into them. I just don't know what it is.
Right, and the red shoes, egg yolks.
There was a point where sugar...
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, no, go on. We're still talking about the food, yeah.
There was a point where sugar was taken, like, as a pick-me-up. So, I mean, you know, there are stories about soldiers taking sugar before war just to get them, you know, in the zone. I think maybe that's... You know, how to start your day back then was to pop a sugar cube or to douse, you know, 3 spoonfuls of sugar onto your melon, and before anybody really thought about the consequences.
That's what donuts are for.
In a very elaborate breakfast coat as well. I love the...
Oh, yes, the costume. Yes, it was amazing.
I just love that, like, you can tell that he's like kind of Soviet era kind of like fashion, and that's his world. And he's almost like this kind of foreigner in a different land that when he comes to London, like he still has all his things about him. But he's also, it strikes me that Lermontov, the character, and they call him a monster, that he's presented like alone and very pale and almost like vampiric in like the dark corners of the world. Like he's always in the shadows or in the darkness, and like he's never
like in the opening scene. The first time we see him, we get a glimpse of his face, and then he's behind the curtain, and we're just seeing his hand with a cigarette. Well, of course, later on at the very end of the film, he does the same thing, but he's out and he's exposed. You know, he's been absolutely torn asunder by this. But yes, he is like a. He's like Orlok or something, isn't he? Creeping around the edges of scenes so often at the beginning.
It's that bit of vulnerability and devastating.
When you mentioned the look of folks in this, one of the things that struck me watching this is that it's a color film, and the colors are popping, and you're just like, wow, with that. But the look of what they do with the makeup of people, and we're not just talking about the theatrical makeup, but just the regular everyday life. It's very dramatic and reminded me of how I would expect a character to look in like a silent film. And, you know, I think that also just kind of brought this otherworldly quality to what we were watching. And it just really grabbed me. Just you're drawn to their faces with the way that they make them up in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
That brings up a good point, how, like, you know, this is so much of this movie is part fantasy. You know, you're getting into like the story of the Red Shoes actually playing out, you know, in the movie. And then you're also seeing this you know, backstage drama, which is considered very realistic at the time, of, you know, just seeing how they're practicing, how they're, you know, rehearsing music. There's a great moment, actually, that when they're walking, Vicky's walking from practice down a hallway, and she walks past Crasser, who's in another room practicing music.
The shadows.
And yeah, and then the camera follows her a little bit past the room, and then it goes back, and it's like, hey, let's look what's in here, and goes into that room. It's just, you know, you're seeing this weird blend of realism and fantasy take place, and I think part of the makeup thing that you point out is one, they're shooting with Technicolor cameras, which required really really hot lights, and so they really had to cake on that makeup, and part of it is like, yeah, it's realistic, but it's also this fantasy that they're telling.
Well, it emphasizes the theatrical nature even outside of the theater, that this is this is kind of a theatrical story with characters and people who are outsized, who have huge personalities and, you know, appearance as well. I mean, everything.
And they live on sets.
Yes.
You know, like that scene where later on Julian and Vicky are, I guess, at home. And, you know, Julian wakes up in bed, and you look at the bedroom, and it kind of looks like it's just sort of a backdrop. And then he goes to the piano, and they're sitting at the piano, and there's this beautiful candelabra. But it doesn't look like an actual interior of a home. It looks like set pieces on a stage.
Yeah.
And you'll also notice, obviously, sort of the great Jack Cardiff was the director of photography here, and there's a lot of matte paintings in the background, except sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's quite clearly, you know, it might still be back projection, but it's still reality. So there's scenes literally where it's quite clearly a matte painting. One scene in particular between Vicky and Julian, it's just a blue wall, but they're pretending they're outside looking at the sea, but it's clearly not. And then other times you're seeing the streets of Monaco busy over the same balconies, and so there's this constant mix of reality and fantasy that's going on. These worlds are colliding, and it's really clear from the stuff that's going in the background.
I think that's a really great point to make, especially because with that kind of leaning into the fantasy side of things, that when you look at it as Vicky being the protagonist of it, it really is a fairy tale story for her. That, like, she goes into this world, and it is like a fairy tale, especially that scene where she goes to meet the head of the studio and ascends the staircase, like, in this beautiful ball gown. Like, where the hell is she going dressed like that?
She's got the gown on, the little crown in the middle of her head, but it's in the most beautiful setting in the world. Every time you look off in the distance, you can see the coast of the Mediterranean and how gorgeous it is. And then she's climbing those stairs that are all strewn with weeds, and it's like, you know, like Belle in Beauty and the Beast. You know, she's going to the fantasy castle here to encounter those folks. And it was just, I kept wondering, why did the cab drop her off there? And we have this long walk and procession up through this beautiful countryside and this kind of dilapidated stairwell. And I thought, because that's what you do in a fantasy. You show the fantasy world that people are living in. And even though it's daylight, it's still a fantasy.
And it's so interesting because my initial thought at that moment was, I don't believe for a second that Lamontov would have been in a place that didn't have a clear stairway. And then, you know, you step back and you go, well, wait a minute. Maybe he's trying to make sure that only the proper people get into his area. You know, like, so then it's like, this is an exclusive place, not just everyone gets in. And, you know, what you just said about that whole Beauty and the Beast idea, like that forbidden area where she's now, you know, traveling into for the very first time.
I really feel like it is like she's entering that inner world, because before the scene, like when she is joining, like from the moment that she actually meets them and has that initial conversation over a champagne cocktail, that he ignores her when she comes to the ballet to like practice dancing, like completely brushes her off, walks by her like he doesn't even see her. And this is like apart from when she asked to go dance for the Mercury Theater and she sees the glimpse of him in the audience only for 2 seconds and then he's gone again. Like, this is the first kind of moment where he really sees her as a person and has that conversation and even seems a bit more human, even his clothes in that scene. Like, he's wearing Mediterranean clothes. He's not dressed up in his kind of vampiric monster getup. Like, this is him being almost a normal person going, like, welcome to our world now. You're finally accepted.
Mm-hmm. I remember when he snubbed her in front of her friend outside the... Covent Garden, yeah. When you know, like, oh, hello, Vicky, how are you doing? Oh, look, we're going to lunch with Lamontov, and just looks at her like,
Yeah. How do you do? Okay.
Yeah, well, not even barely that, is it? But again, this is his game, isn't it? This is what he does. This is how, it's like training an animal. You know, you treat it. That's his technique, and it's mm-hmm.
It's how you break them down.
Exactly. Treat them mean, keep them keen.
I mean, to go to a terrible kind of thing, but you know, this idea of getting her to work that much harder for his attention.
Mm. Yes.
You know, and to show off and get her to work more to prove herself to him, which is exactly what he wants. He wants her to work that much harder so that he can mold her and so that she will do whatever he says, no matter what.
I completely get that, especially because she is coming from this world of privilege. Like her aunt that she's at the theater with at the beginning of the movie is the countess, is the lady. So she comes from like this upper class world where like she almost, I'd say she's used to getting what she wants. And he's the first person to say, no, I don't want an audition in this like party. So like that's the first snub. And then him calling her a horror and her going back on, I am that horror. Like him kind of breaking her down, going like, you're not going to get your way with me. Like, this is like, you're going to play by my rules if you want to be in my game.
All right. I have a question for all those people on the show who do drink a little bit. I've wondered this for 25, 30 years. Is there a difference between a champagne and a champagne cocktail?
Yeah, it's like a Bellini or what's the other one that you have a brunch? Mimosa.
Mimosas, yeah.
So they put something in it. They juice some juice in it. Yeah. Okay. I was just wondering. I don't know.
I'm a teetotaler. Sugar.
Yeah. It's a
probably
bit of a
some more sugar, yes.
That you dip in
yeah. That's probably it.
Also, you can also put cognac in it or brandy or something like that.
Ooh. Well, thank you.
I'm not that fancy, but now I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
I've learned something today, but not quite a recipe.
Can we talk about the what is the set piece of in the middle of the movie that like is absolutely breathtaking and just where Vicky is about to go on stage and perform the Red Cheese for the first time, and we see the ballet from her eyes of what she's imagining while she's on stage. Can we talk about that scene now for the moment? Because
I love that.
I was waiting for you to do that. I was blown away. That's got to be one of the most breathtaking 17 minutes of films I've ever watched. It's
absolutely
amazing.
Loved it.
And I was just thrilled by all the different elements that you know work together in that. You know, the from the music to the ballet itself to the sets and the makeup and the costumes and the various kind of, you know, the fantasy elements that we've talked about. I mean, as a puppeteer, I was struck by the sequence with the newspaper, which is, you know,
incredible. You know,
go ahead, Richard. Yeah,
I was just going to say, I'm looking at that effect and I'm going, now, how did they do that back in 1948?
Yes.
I know that how they would do it today. It would be, you know, a CGI thing. But this...
And remember, this is a low budget British film.
Yeah.
This isn't Hollywood. Yeah. Powell and Pressburger weren't the most popular, successful directors in contemporary wise. To a degree, they tried to bury this film, the Rank organization. Didn't get released for a year. So all the effort and the skills and things that were put into this, it's actually quite
creative.
It is really remarkable and creative, absolutely.
I loved watching that part with that newspaper, with that element. I liked the transition. Those costumes were my favorite when it transitioned to essentially like her wearing the kind of newsprint. Mm-hmm. Those were the outfits that I liked, the costumes that I liked the best. You can tell I'm not a dancer because I don't go to costume immediately. But Meg, you mentioned like this is that whole surrealist fantasy perception thing was what she is seeing. And it's funny because I didn't make the connection. I understood it, I guess, if you could allow that, to say that, you know, okay, this is the blurring of the lines between fantasy and reality. But you somehow just saying now that this is what she was, quote unquote, seeing really kind of cements it that much further. And I'm going to go back and watch that ballet again, just that one section. Because it was interesting, because it's the kind of thing I think most people would be taken out of the film. They would struggle with it. They wouldn't be able to deal with it. But it's something that I really gravitate to, this idea of the blurring of worlds and the idea of, you know, these other universes beyond our perception. And the idea that when she is in this moment, in each moment of that ballet, that this is where she is, despite where the audience sees her or where her partner sees her, this is where she is in those moments.
Right. And I think this kind of goes...
What were you saying? That... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
This kind of goes into what I was saying before about, you know, Paul and Pressburger wanting to blend, you know, ballet and cinema into something there. So while, Meg, I think your point about this is what she sees is absolutely true, and I think I've been maybe thinking about this movie too much from, you know, just reading about Paul and Pressburger in the past, because they're, you know, like I said, they're blending, they're showing you ballet, but then they're turning that into cinema. And so they're showing you what ballet can do and then what cinema can do, which is a very, you know, kind of pretentious directorial ambition. But yeah, I absolutely agree that you're in her head through that sequence, and you're seeing everything that she's seeing. And I think there are things that, well, there absolutely are things that just can't happen on the stage in that moment. And that was pointed out before, whether it's, you know, her reflection dancing on its own, you know, in the shop window. That's something that absolutely can't happen. There are just, you know, moments where she's falling for a long time. There are just all these things that cannot happen.
Putting on the shoes.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's a, you know, you could argue that maybe there's, you know, a contraption under the stage with, like, you know, little white, you can see the strings that, you know, they shot it in reverse and or portrayed it in reverse, you know, the strings that are pulling the ties off the shoes. But yeah, it's this idea that it's her experiencing it is a great observation.
Well, and I think that some of the most striking moments of that sequence are those ones that couldn't possibly, you know, happen and are a bit more, you know, what's going on in her head. My favorite moment of that whole thing was when we're seeing it more from the standpoint of if we were backstage and looking out towards the audience, but there's no audience. It's just the conductor. And then the conductor walks up onto the stage and then becomes the dancer she's dancing with. That was just an amazing moment.
It's because nothing matters but the music.
That's it.
And of course, what I guess you guys know this, but this, as I said before, this film wasn't very well received, and the critics had a right go at this moment. So everything that we're swooning over, and it is a remarkable piece of cinema, and you know, you compare it to the bit in Spellbound that Salvador Dali did, that just feels like, that doesn't fit. This just works perfectly. Because we've had that mix of fantasy and reality all the way through it. This is just the culmination or the crux of it. But at the time, people were going, well, that's not how ballet is. That's not right. And so contemporary critics really hated that. Yet here we are, well, 80 years later. I don't know how long later it is. It's we're swooning over it, yeah?
I think it took on another life when it was restored and shown a can. Like, I think so many people today have found that film from then, because Martin Scorsese, he cited it as one of his favorite films, like one of the two most beautifully colored films that there are. And because he championed it so much, I think so many people came to it from there.
I mean, he's literally taken shots from this film into his other films, hasn't he? You
know, the influence.
He's doing this. Yeah, but when she's like spinning around, when she's doing the thing at she's doing Swan Lake at that small little.
Uh-huh.
And she's spinning around, and you see her spinning around. Well, he takes that into Raging Bull, and you see it was absolutely, this is like one of his favorite films of all time. And I think you're right. I think it's had a second life. I mean, don't get me wrong, it did eventually become successful. It was just buried for a year.
It was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. Lost to Hamlet, of course, but it got art direction and musical score, which are both, like, that says it all about a movie about the making of movies, that it's about the art and the music coming together.
somebody at home was like, see, I was right, I told you.
But just coming back to what you were saying, Lisa, that the reason why I like it connected straight away with me, like, this is what is in her head. Like, there's so much of the story that on first watch you can't explain, and it seems quite abrupt, but like, if you in the dialogue, it's all in the dialogue. Like, when she's having that first breakfast meeting with Craster and he's playing the music for her and she's like, it's too fast, the tempo's all wrong, and he's asking her, what are you going to picture when you're up there on stage? And she's like, a war between me and the audience. And he's like, well, what about this scene? And she's like, don't play me that. And it's like, oh, it's the ball scene. Oh, we've cut the ball scene. Yes, but it's still in the score. The audience will see a ball if they know, if they listen to the music. And I feel like there's so many moments like that that are, it's the classic example of show, don't tell. And like, mm-hmm. even though they are telling, they're like, they're showing it to you much better. And I love the way that there's so much is communicated in this film by visuals alone, especially like the use of signage and the use of words on screen.
And of course, yeah. he says, doesn't he, just before she goes on stage, it's all right, Vicky, I'm changing the tempo, whatever you want. And that yeah. tells you, actually, something's gone on in between those two scenes, which means their relationship has flip-flopped. And that's what he's saying, you know, they're telling us, not showing us again.
And I love that point that, Meg, you say, where everything is there in the dialogue, and it shows just what high quality this film really is. Because, you know, sure, I saw it once. I saw it, you know, yesterday. I watched this film. It was brilliant. I'll definitely be watching it again. To know that there's still that much there to take out of it each time you see it, and that it's not, that it is show, don't tell, because if it was driven by the dialogue and if it was more heavy-handed to make sure you knew, oh yeah, this is what's in her head, make sure you look for it, then it definitely wouldn't be as high quality
logical.
As it. Yes, exactly. So you have films where they do go too heavy-handed on the exposition and making sure you understand here's what's coming.
Well, that's a characteristic of ballet. You know, there's not narration, there's not interaction and dialogue, there's dance, and there's the performance and the music, and that's what you have to get your story from.
Yeah. Exactly. Even the, just like, briefly back to the breakfast, the first breakfast meeting between Craster and Vicky, this is like, we're told that, like, on first, like, I watched this movie so many times, and even rewatching it this week, I took new things from it. Like, it's one of those movies, it just keeps on giving and giving. It is that because they're put together in those breakfast meetings, that he is to be with her every breakfast, dinner, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner until the performance. They do have those moments of bonding, but it's off screen because it literally cuts from the breakfast to the performance. But they have created a rapport even in that first meeting, so like, it's only natural that when they're put together for that amount of time that they will develop some sort of feelings towards each other.
Yeah, and I think it's also just a quality of you know, older cinema, where people tend to fall in love, you know, over the course of a day, fall in love and want to get married over the course of a day, mm-hmm. and you don't always see, you know, what we would consider a natural progression, but there is, you know, there are all these examples of things happening in between scenes. There's also this idea of them being Romeo and Juliet, which there were several sort of references to that. And I think, you know, that tells us everything we need to know. They're, you know, they're called a great
go well.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. You know, they're first seen together, or not first seen together, but when they kind of meet on the balcony and they know they're going to work on the red shoes. I mean, that's the balcony that she's going to jump off of and die later in the movie.
And the train goes by in that scene as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so the movie is just setting up that, yes, this is a great romance, and you don't need to know all the details. It's just, it's there. This is one of the great stories.
And, you know, they foreshadow the end earlier also, because when Limonov tells the conclusion of the red shoes, oh, and she dies. He
yeah.
tosses it off very casually.
It's all in dialogue.
Right. Yeah.
Can I just say, on the casting, the guy who plays Julian Craster, how old is he? Do people think he's supposed to be in this?
That's a question.
He's supposed to be in his early 20s, but he looks about 42.
Yeah, he must be the oldest looking sort of student of the Royal Academy of Arts that has ever been. But isn't that it, art? Doesn't everybody in the 40s in England look 20 years older than they were? So He does look like sort of a low rent Dickie Attenborough, doesn't he?
I think he was only in his 30s at the time, like mid 30s.
Yeah. But he's definitely meant to be, you know, people go to university at 18.
Sure.
So I assume he's in his sort of first year of studying, first years of studying music, so he's no older than 22.
And yet those wrinkles on his forehead would say otherwise.
Well, he's suffered for his art.
And I suppose I think the story speaks for itself, but like the influence of the movie on other films, like has everyone seen Black Swan? And then the amount of scenes from this that you can recall into Black Swan, like it really is
recounting
of it.
I would say The Sound of Music, or not The Sound of Music, Singing in the Rain. You know, the whole the Ballet of the Red Shoes sequence is very much like the Broadway Melody sequence in Singing in the Rain, where it just kind of, you know, you go from what in Singing in the Rain is a rehearsal, I think, of a scene that's going to be in a movie, and it actually just, you know, devolves in a way into this elaborate dance series of dances that, you know, sort of transcend what's happening in the text of the story at the time. And then and just like this, you know, critics at the time were very just hated that sequence, and it took years and years for that sequence to be really lauded for how beautiful it is.
It was often cut from TV screenings, by the way, because I remember seeing Singing in the Rain after school, when I would come home from school, and it would be on the afternoon movie, and I never saw that scene until I saw That's Entertainment, and they referred to it, and then I saw the film later on. I said, wait a second, where was this in the movie? And that was just, you know, a typical kind of thing that they said, well, this doesn't fit in with everything else. It's so different. But it's exactly like the long ballet sequence that we have in The Red Shoes, which is all largely with, I mean, there's no dialogue. We're seeing everything. It's the music and the dance that's going on there. And it's a long sequence. I know a lot of people think that that's strange, but it kind of, you know, it's also in An American in Paris. We get a similar kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Has everyone seen Tales of Hoffman? Or anybody seen that?
Not seen
No,
it.
It's on, not. It's currently a movie, though.
Yeah, it's It's basically a feature-length version of that sequence. It's a ballet on film, and it's quite amazing. It's by Paula Pressburger.
Yeah, it's kind of like what Fantasia did for just kind of like or music against animation. It's like just ballet on screen, but it's a lot of the same cast.
Oh, you're speaking
as well.
My language.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Powell and Pressburger had a sort of group of people that they worked with. So especially in this block of films from Colonel Blimp up to Tales of Hoffman, I'd Witch This and Black Narcissus and the other one, Matter of Life and Death, you know, you'll see Krasner, the guy that played Krasner is in Matter of Life and Death, isn't he? Conductor 71. The girl, what's the actress?
She's Moira Shearer.
Moira's in Peeping Tom.
Yes, I did see that.
I remember that,
And she didn't even like Powell. she worked with him a couple of more times after this. In fact, she hated him. In fact, that's funny that what you were saying earlier about, you know, the Levinoff's, you know, the sort of the way he is with his people. It does sound a bit like he was a bit like that. And he didn't give anyone the time of day and was quite horrible to them and didn't interact with them properly. But he had had a cast of a troupe, I guess, that their archers, their sort of production company would always call upon. You'll find certainly in that tranche of seven or eight films, lots of people popping up in two or three of them.
Yeah, Anton Walbrook is another one who, you know, he was in Colonel Blimp and this, and he's just, you know, he's such a sensitive character in Colonel Blimp, and then he just turns into this monster. He has such range between those two films. It's pretty impressive.
All right, Meg, do you have anything else that you wanted us to focus on? We've been talking for a while.
I know. I think we've covered the cinematography, the acting, the story. I've got a quiz, but is there anyone who's got any other kind of thoughts or things they want to bring up about the film? No? Okay, no. It's time for a quiz, I suppose. And I would just say, like, anyone listening, like, please do check out The Red Shoes. Watch it.
Absolutely.
Go.
Are you talking about the game for the show? We're going to save that until after the break.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
That's okay. That's okay. But I think we will give lamb scores here before we take a quick break.
Ooh, good point.
So, Todd, how about you? What's your lamb score for this? It's out of five, remember.
I'm going to go 4.5. Very, very glad to finally, like I say, get to mark this off my shame list. It's a breathtaking film, so enjoyed it very much.
And Lisa, how about you?
I'm going full tilt. I'm going 5 out of 5 for this one. And I don't have a shame list, but I've got a giant poster on my wall from Pop Chart of, like, you know, 1,000 films you need to see, and I was able to fill in a circle for this one, so I'm pretty excited about that.
So it gets extra points because it helps you fulfill a personal goal. That's good. I like that.
Absolutely.
Stephen, how about you? What do you think?
I'm going to sound like I'm being harsh on it, only because it's only my third favorite Powell and Pressburger film, and therefore where would I go? So I'm going to give it a 4, but I'm quite tight with numbers, so a 4, but that just means it's brilliant.
All right, Brian?
This is absolutely a 5 out of 5 for me. Paul and Pressburger are a couple of my, you know, well, together, they're a favorite director. And, this kind of just checks all the boxes for me. It holds up to, you know, intellectual scrutiny. It's so well made. I feel every emotion watching this movie. It's outstanding.
Very nice. And Meg, I don't think there's going to be a lot of surprise with your rating. Why don't you tell us what it is anyway?
No, it's going to be 5 out of 5. I absolutely adore this film. I come back to it time and time again. I've gone to see a ballet or theater shows based on it. I've listened to the Kate Bush album that was inspired by it. Like, I've watched movies that were inspired by it as well. Just, like, I love the kind of the tentacles this movie, like, leads to as well, as just, like, being a film about creative passion, and as someone who is creative, like, I just, it just speaks to me so much, and I absolutely adore this film.
Well, I'm not going to surprise anybody, I don't think, because I also thought it was incredibly impressive. I was a little critical about a couple of things, but those criticisms don't matter in light of all of the other fantastic things in this movie. This is a 5 for me as well. So, those are our comments about The Red Shoes. If you have an opinion that you want to share, be sure and leave the comments on the LAM site, and we'd be happy to read about them. We're going to take a short break here while we hear from another LAM Podcasting Network show.
Do you like movie podcasts hosted by inebriated people? That's Kai with the cracking voice and Heather's touched by evil. One thinks he's Spider-Man, the other is a ninja. It's the Man I Love Film Podcast, it's the Milkcast.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai.
And I'm Heather.
And we are the hosts of MILFcast, the Man I Love Films podcast, the unofficial, official podcast of ManILoveFilms.com. This is the podcast where we like to talk about what we've been watching, talk about movies, but mainly we just like to drink, be silly, and play a whole bunch of games. So we think every other week you should grab a drink, snuggle up, and let us make sweet love to your ears.
Otherwise, we'll make sweet love to your couch.
So come and find us on iTunes. Just search for MILFcast.
I don't know what we're yelling about!
And we're back, and it's time for rants, raves, or reviews for the week. Everybody's supposed to have something to talk about, and I'm sure they do. Brian, we're going to start with you. What are you ranting, raving, or reviewing this week?
I am reviewing The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which is a kind of an indie horror comedy that came out last year. This happens every year where, you know, you make a top 10 list, but there's still some things to see, and then you regret your top 10 list. And The Wolf of Snow Hollow, I don't know that it would be in my top 10, but it would definitely be in my top 25. It's, I don't know if anybody's seen Thunder Road from 2018, same writer, director, and kind of the same idea, by Jim Cummings. He's also the star of the film. In both Thunder Road and The Wolf of Snow Hollow, he's playing this sort of agonized, awkward, high-stressed character who's dealing with a divorce. He's dealing with the death of a parent. And then he's dealing with just, you know, a lot of personal issues, which lead him to have kind of outbursts, and it's all very funny and very sad and very, like, almost cringy to watch, but it's very entertaining. In The Wolf of Snow Hollow, that character basically is just dealing with a series of killings in Utah. Some automatically believe that it's a werewolf, which is surprising, and some say, you know, werewolves don't exist. This is insane. What are you saying? And the way it works itself out is really fascinating. It's something that after I watched, I've been thinking about it for days and just how well it worked. You know, it's balancing a lot of tones from, again, being really funny to really dark. It's got like a serial killer, like let's find the serial killer element. It's got a horror element to it. It just works on so many levels, and it's surprisingly resonant in its emotions as well. I found myself, you know, borderline tears with this movie, just how wounded this main character is. So a great movie. It's, you know, a 83 minute horror comedy, which, you know, seems like it should be just light entertainment, but it's got a lot of emotion, a lot of heart. It's also just extremely bloody for people who are into, you know, gore and that sort of thing. So like I said, it's got a lot of elements going on. I highly recommend it.
Can you tell us where to find it?
It's widely available to rent, I think, on Amazon. I don't think it's free on any services right now.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be. I'm looking it up now.
Yeah. Good deal. All right, Steven, how about you? What are you going to rant, rave, or review about?
Well, I had a bit of a change. I'm not sure if this is a rant, a rave, or a review. but it's something I wanted to talk about.
That's fine.
So, obviously, this episode we've talked about one of the great British directors of all time. Obviously, he worked quite closely with a Hungarian fella, but yeah, let's just pretend it's just I'm holding the flag for England here. But one of our great directors passed away this week, Michael Apted.
Oh yes.
Who you know, had a long and varied career, starting directing soap operas in the UK. Currently, he's directing episodes of Coronation Street, not that I mean anything to most of you that are here. You know, he went on to get Oscar nominated films like Gorillas in the Mist, a film I watched last night, Gorky Park, which is actually what I was going to talk about, but then I thought about something else. And also the worst Bond movie of all time, which is Well, It's Not Enough. But you know, not everybody can.
That is not the worst one. We've been through that.
We'll have this discussion. It's not the worst, not great.
Yeah, it's not one anyone's going to take with them to the desert island, right?
But it's not even the worst.
Okay. Oh, okay, all right. Enough about that. What I wanted to talk about is that he has been part of a piece of filmmaking which has existed as long as I've been alive. In fact, 7 years longer than I've been alive. He was part of an original documentary called Seven Up, which takes the basically took a bunch of 7-year-old children from across the United Kingdom and sort of talked to them at 7 years age and how they thought they were going to, where they were going to be in the future, what their lives are like and things like that. And then he took the directing reins up, and every 7 years after that we revisited the same children. So basically for my whole life, and we're up to I think 63 up was last year, maybe no, year before. And us in England or in Britain, we've grown up with these kids, and now they're old age pensioners, I guess. And I just wanted to sort of bring that to everyone's attention, that there's this project, this film project that went on. It's been a staple of British TV every 7 years, and now he's passed away. I don't know if we're going to get AG4 up. I hope we do. But yeah, just wanted to sort of raise a virtual glass to Michael Apted.
Perfectly appropriate.
Yeah,
I
heard of his passing.
Yeah,
I heard of his passing this week, and you know, he's one of those names that you always see pop up, and I'm always surprised at just the diverse selection of films that he has directed. I mean, you know, you mentioned Gorillas in the Mist. The year before that, he directed a not terribly good Richard Pryor comedy, Critical Condition. You know, it's like, but he's got some real gems in his career. I mean, one of the movies that, you know, last year I watched for the first time, and it's one that where you just kick yourself and go, I should have watched that 20 years ago, was Coal Miner's Daughter. It's just a wonderful movie. And, you know, but and then also like, you know, in 84, he directed an often forgotten teen film called Firstborn, which I watched a few years ago. And I love 1984. Richard and I have talked about this many times, our appreciation for 1984 films. And Firstborn is a underrated gem from that year. So, yeah, a very interesting and diverse career for Michael Apted.
And he's also an important professional, having served as president of the Directors Guild and making contributions to his field in that regard as well. So I think it's definitely appropriate for us to have talked about him on this show. All right, Lisa, what are you ranting, raving, or reviewing?
So I just got to Antebellum this week. And it's interesting because I've been reading some of the reviews and I'm actually surprised its rating as low as it did, because I actually really enjoyed it. And I've been kind of grappling with, I mean, yes, it is heavy-handed in a lot of ways. And I when I disagree so much with sort of what the general populace sees, I start looking for, okay, what did I miss? And so you have a number of different critics who talk about, again, the heavy-handedness, how it's kind of an exploitation film, how it's a little bit lacking in, as far as opportunities for talents in the film to really show off. And it makes me wonder if, again, this is a film that was advertised poorly. You know, I don't watch trailers before going into films, and so I had no clue about this movie except that I wanted to see it.
How did you know you wanted to see it?
Because I knew it was a horror film.
Okay.
And that's where it stops with me, because it's one of those things where I went, oh, this is suspenseful, and I really love Monet, sort of just as an artist. I think she's remarkable. So I went, okay, well, I'm going to see this. So yeah, I'm that person. I sit in the movie theater and I actually close my eyes and I don't look, because I'm more, I am, people have looked at me and been like, really? And I'm like, yeah, this is what I do. I don't look. If a commercial comes on television, I will like either try and fast forward through it if it's something I've DVR'd, or I'll actually hold my hand up and I just mute the TV. I won't look. Simply because I've been annoyed by how much is given away in trailers. So I go into everything cold now. And so just kind of hearing that it was creepy and the music was creepy, I went, cool, I'm in. And so then watching the trailer afterwards, I think it was a movie that wasn't what people were going to see. Having gone in cold, I had a bit of a struggle with the time jump, where I was like, oh, this is a dream. Okay, I get it now. I'm going to move on with this. And I liked the characters a lot. I was fascinated by what was going on. And despite the fact that, yes, it is heavy-handed, I don't think it rates as low as it did. I don't know if any of you have seen it and what your thoughts are, if you think I'm crazy and you hated it. I don't know. I really appreciated it for what it was, and I thought it was remarkably interesting.
I did see it, and I liked it as well, and I tend not to read reviews until I've written a review, and then I kind of see what other people think, and apparently, you know, I think it had something like a 20% rating in Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And, I was like, what did I miss here? And I read some of the reviews, and I get that it's treating an issue of, you know, slavery and just racism in America with a little bit of, I don't know, like a light touch maybe, and heavy-handedness at the same time. Like, you're putting the very heavy themes into a genre movie, and I think that rubbed some people the wrong way. At least that was my impression of some of the reviews I read. But I think, you know, there's no message that you can't tell in a genre movie. And I thought it did a good job. Yes, it was a little heavy-handed. Yes, I thought the ending was a little bit overblown. But I think the basic idea of it And it's kind of a, I don't want to spoil anything, but you're just seeing two timelines, and how they reconcile is very fascinating. And what's actually going on is very fascinating and very disturbing, and not all that together unbelievable, especially today in America.
I agree with you on that, Brian.
Yeah, so I think I liked it too. I thought it was thrilling. I was convinced by what was happening. And while I understand, you know, people kind of raising issue with that, I think that it does more good than it does harm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was the kind of thing where, I mean, granted, it's not setting out to be some of the more serious period pieces about slavery in general.
Right.
It didn't strike me as being caricaturish, but maybe some people think differently. I don't know. I just thought the themes of it were very appropriate. I thought some of the more subtleties between various characters were interesting. I think Gaboree Sidibe is a treasure, and she needs to be in everything. But I don't know. I was surprised by how, I mean, loathed, I guess. It really was. Like, when I first watched it, I said, okay, now, yeah, this didn't do well at the theater. I wonder why, and let me watch it. And it was like, okay, well, why did this do so poorly? And then you see what you said. Like, it's like a 26 on Rotten Tomatoes. And it was like, oh, people hated this. Like, it's almost like people hated this just slightly less than they hated Mother.
Right.
And it was like, oh, well, okay. And
I'm going to keep this in mind for a future tomato meter game.
Yeah, I think you need to.
The low reading will probably throw some people off.
I think the kind of the Twitter discourse about this film, I haven't watched it, but I remember seeing the trailer and then seeing people kind of like talk ill of it online. I think it's more to do with the kind of the portrayal of black people in films, and especially after the summer with Black Lives Matter, that like sometimes it feels that like the only black stories that get told and get attention are ones of black misery. And I think that people thought that it was the violence in this was a bit gratuitous and unnecessary, and that maybe that left a sour taste in their mouths, and maybe that's why it got such low ratings.
And you know what, that would be in a very, very valid way of putting it. So that would make absolute sense to me. Yes, I can see that.
All right. Well, thank you, Lisa.
That was my comment.
All right. Todd, what have you got?
Well, I'm going to rant, and this is, you know, something that is probably more on me than anything, but I love Letterboxd. I've become very religious about every time I watch a movie, I'm right on there afterwards logging that I've watched it. The most depressing day of the year for me is January 1st, when my count of movies watched for the year is at zero, you know. But anyway, I somehow did not realize that the wonderful, lovely email that I get shortly after the year changes over each year that gives me a recap of what I've done has now changed as part of, you know, the service you got to pay for. And I was totally bummed that I didn't get my nice little email that listed all that stuff. So, you know, probably they announced it like 6 months ago and I just didn't notice, you know, because I'm like that. But, you know, it was just kind of sad, and I want my email, so... Sorry.
I would have been bummed by that too. I don't pay for Letterboxd either. I thought you were going to tell me something about like the owners of the website were horrible people and I was going to have to stop.
No.
I was bracing myself up.
We get so spoiled by free stuff, I tell you,
I know,
online. And this week I was trying to post the Lambcast from last week, and I apparently had run out of space on Podomatic, and I was having difficulty resolving it. I had to go to the Shepherd to clear out a whole bunch of things. I actually ended up paying for the service that we've been using for free for the past 10 years, and I said, well, I'll just pay and create this storage space that I need. Didn't fix my problem. I still needed to do some other things, but I know how quickly we, you know, that was free before, and now I have to pay for it, and, you know, it was free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
I'm cheap. What can I say? I try to do everything.
I gotcha.
And you know, it's like the Letterboxd thing too. I think, you know, it's all that particular thing is only in the, you know, what, $19.99 for the year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could do it, but I'm a cheapskate.
I gotcha.
And that stuff adds up. all these little subscriptions that we do, the monthly ones, the annual ones, you first of all, you lose track. Secondly, they add up. So I can see it. I'm with you.
Yeah, and when I say free, by the way, I know that they're mining your data, so they should be paying you.
I know. They're all reading my mind and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Meg, what are you going to rant and rave about?
I'll just say quickly, just there on the topic there, that like it is the old adage that like if you're not paying for a service, yeah, like you are the product. So they are the whole mining of the data. But I was torn between talking about two movies. Like the Irish cinemas briefly opened up in December and now they're shut again until February, which is wreaking havoc with my kind of watch list. But I got to go see Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor in the cinema. But I also, I think I want to talk about Wolfwalkers just because it's an Irish film and I love championing Irish movies on this show as well. And has anyone seen Wolfwalkers briefly before I get into it?
I haven't seen it, but it was discussed extensively last week.
Going on the list.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite movies of last year.
Fantastic to hear. So I'm going to be just kind of briefly just talking about Wolfwalkers. Is that anyone doesn't know, it's the latest effort from the Kilkenny studio Cartoon Saloon based here in Ireland. And it was an Apple original. So it's on Apple TV Plus, which is my newest subscription because I got it free with my phone. The only reason I have it. But
free stuff. What am I telling you here?
And it came with a phone. I bought a phone and then it came with the phone. So that's a good model. Like people are going to be like, in a year, there's not that much on Apple TV. I will say that there's like a couple of original shows and like just there's not enough content on there on that you don't have to pay for. So I don't think it's worth it. So that's the only reason why. But Wolfwalkers will make it worth it. Put it that way. So Wolfwalkers is a 2D, beautifully drawn animation about I don't know. It's not medieval. It's the kind of Cromwellian time of a Kilkenny city and a young girl called Maeve and her father, who is a wolf catcher, and the wolf walkers that are in the forest are these Irish mother and daughter shapeshifters who command a pack of wolves, and the city is trying to get rid of the wolves and destroy their land. Like, it's a beautiful story of like female friendship. The two girls become friends, but it's also about environmentalism, like the tearing down the forest and kind of the colonial powers coming into the city and trying to change the landscape to their fitting. And it's just the way it's drawn is absolutely gorgeous. The perspectives are all over the place, which is beautiful. The voice actors of the two girls, the two leads, are amazing. Sean Bean is in it, Murray Doyle Kennedy is in it, and it's a wonderful kind of fairy tale. And it's the kind of story that I used to love seeing when I was a child, like back in like the 80s and 90s, those the old kind of like Disney movies and oh my God, what's his name? Five O Goes West and American Tale.
Don Bluth.
We need to do an episode on Don Bluth because I've got so much to say on the topic.
But yes, I'm in on that.
100%.
Well, you could suggest that as a kind of look back episode, maybe for the franchise movie of the month look back in April.
Ooh, that'd be good. But I really enjoyed this movie, like Cartoon Saloon's previous efforts, The Book of Kells and Song of the Sea nominated for Best Animation at the Oscars when it came out. Like, they're really going to strength to strength as a studio, and especially because the style that they use, like, it's very singular, it's very them, it's no one else's. And they use like different artists and illustrators in Ireland to work on the backgrounds, to work on the characters, and there's just so many creative, unique voices that contribute to their projects. And I was really excited to see what they would do with a bigger budget that was supplied by Apple, and it did not disappoint at all. It was absolutely amazing film. I'm so glad I got to watch it, and everyone else should watch it.
Well, let's make sure you listen to last week's show where Brian had very nice things to say about it as well.
Yay.
Well, I'm going to share something that is a kind of a rave about a rant. It's bad news at the end of the year whenever we have to look back and think about all the people that we've lost that were so important in our movie lives. But I appreciate the effort that people put into doing that. I happened to cross a little tribute to Alex Trebek from Jeopardy the other day, and apparently it played on the last show that he was on. And I really appreciated the fact that they had a clip of him in the show you know, he's got the Trojan Marching Band drum major's outfit on at one point because it's a Southern California USC thing. And he also appears as Gene Simmons in one of the episodes. So, you know, two of my favorite things going on there. But it also reminded me of the TCM Remembers look back that I had seen a couple of weeks before. Yeah. And those things always tear at your heart. See how many people. And it's not complete. There's always people missing, but... if it was complete, I think we'd all just start crying for the rest of the week. So I would like people to take a little bit of time to look back at all of the changes that we've had in our lives as a result of not just COVID, but old age as well. And we have to move on, but we do want to remember those folks that passed before us. And that's just one way of doing so. So on that cheerful note, go ahead.
Well, the TCM Remembers are always just the most beautifully done ones. It always catches me off guard each year because, you know, they release it, maybe about a week or two before the holidays. And, you know, suddenly it pops up on my screen. I go, oh, my, and I watch it. And, yeah, by the end, I'm just in tears. And I love that TCM especially – just pulls out these folks that you're not going to get just anywhere. I remember a few years ago, one of the people they highlighted was a guy that played Godzilla in many Toho films. And I was like, only TCM would do that. And it's just beautiful. So,
well, good. Like I said, on that cheerful note, let's play the game that Meg's got for us. I know that she's got a quiz for us. So, Meg, take it away.
Okay, so because we are covering a dance movie, notably a ballet movie, I thought I would make a quick 10 question quiz, like first buzzer gets to answer, but they're all about dance movies or ballet movies, so I hope you brushed up on your knowledge.
I'm well bored,
hi. So if you know the answer, shout out your name, and we'll whoever shouts first, then we'll agree on who. Because people are going to be chatting over each other, gets to answer first. And if they get it, they get a point. And there are bonus points if you answer extra parts of the questions. Okay. So question one. This 2018 remake was set in Germany at a dance school and featured Tilda Swinton.
Lisa. Todd. Richard. Steven.
Lisa.
Suspiria.
Yes, correct.
Brilliant remake.
Good. Fantastic. Movie. Oh, my God. One of the best remakes. Like, they're both on their own, like, they both stand on their own equally. Like, they're so good.
Definitely. And I horror remake? Fan, I am not a remake person. Loved it. You didn't like it?
I thought the remake was the most dire piece of nonsense. The original's a classic.
I agree with you on that. Oh, my God.
I thought it was, yeah. Sorry.
I didn't make it. It's okay.
No.
Suspiria next October, folks.
Dude, I'm telling you, now it's going out as a movie of the month for me, because now I want Steven to talk about it with me.
There you
Brilliant.
Go.
Brilliant. question two. How many films are there in the Step Up dance movie franchise?
Steven.
Brian.
Steven.
I'm just going to say a number. 5.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Bonus point.
The way you said your name, I thought you knew.
Anything like that, I just thought it'd be a number. It'd be more than 3, wouldn't it?
Okay, you will get an extra few points if you can name all of the Step Up movies.
Come on, Stephen, make us proud.
No googling.
I'm afraid that point is going to go into the ether. We give it to charity because I'm not even going to try.
Well, you can name one of them.
Step Up.
How about Step Up 2?
There's Step Up 2. I think it's called Step Up to the Streets or something like that. Yeah.
That is correct.
I don't know any of the others.
Step Up Again?
Step Up 3, Step Up Revolution, and Step Up All In.
Do you mean it wasn't Step Up 3D?
No. It wasn't in 3D, but I don't think they called it 3D.
There were no children in the Step Up films.
Live Free or Step Up.
A good day to step up.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Steve, was it you who said the Step Up to the Streets?
No.
I said that.
quite many.
Brilliant.
God
has
okay.
the hidden knowledge.
Okay, so question three. This, in the 2007 movie Hot Rod, Rod Kimball lampoons this scene from another famous dance movie, and he starts off the scene before by saying, "I need to go to my quiet place." Name that film that they lampoon.
Brian? Footloose?
Yes. It is an excellent scene.
I'm going to take your word for it.
Literally, just look up my genre. Hot Rod. Look up Hot Rod, I need to go to my quiet place, and you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't know about that. It's not my realm, but I'll take work.
I will fight people to watch Hot Rod and not come away laughing from it. It is fantastic.
I don't want to disappoint, so I'm not going to go there.
This 2018 horror movie has a bowl of punch that's been spiked in a lot of dancers. Name that movie.
Ryan.
I can't hear the question. Sorry.
Climax.
Yes. Sorry, is my mic okay? Can everyone hear me?
Yeah. I can now. I just, something glitched and I didn't catch it, but that's okay.
No problem. You can catch up. Don't worry. This 1995 film set in Las Vegas is in the top 10 of the best bad movies ever made.
Brian? Showgirls?
Yes.
Oh.
Featuring Nomi Malone. It is a dance movie, technically.
Yeah. I suppose.
She's a dancer.
There is dancer. Body movement on stage.
There is an excellent clip on YouTube of scenes from Showgirls without the music. I would highly recommend it. okay, we're on question four. West Side Story from 1961 features Richard Bremer and Russ Tamblyn as Tony and Riff. But they also starred together in a TV show from the 1980s, 1990s. Can you name that TV show?
Richard.
I was going to say Richard.
Twin Peaks.
Yes, it is. Bonus points if you can name their characters in Twin Peaks.
Oh, Dr. What's his name? I can't remember. Jeez. It's not Tab Hunter. You said his name before. The dancer guy. From West Side Story. Richard Bremer plays, I can't remember the characters' names. Let's just skip on to the next one.
It was, Richard Horn. What? It's Dr. Jacoby and...
Dr. Jacoby and Horn was
Audrey Horn's dad.
Audrey Horn's dad.
Ben Horn, thank you.
Benjamin.
Sorry. Yeah. My partner, Barry, in the background.
I could have used those extra points. Damn.
Okay. In the 2010 movie Black Swan, you see a lot of scenes that are borrowed in The Red Shoes, but can you name the film that Darren Aronofsky went to the point of buying the rights to so that he could use scenes from that in Black Swan? Stephen.
Is it Perfect Blue?
Yes, it is.
I couldn't be Asian Cinema Film Club without getting that, could I, really?
Nice.
And, oh, yes, we've got two more questions. So, unless people, well, Steve, you're trailing right behind Brian, so you know.
Okay. If I win a quiz about dancing.
Film featuring that. The 2000 film Billy Elliot premiered at Cannes. But can you name the original title that I had to change because it got confused with Dancer in the Dark?
Apparently not.
Three, two, one. Okay, nobody got that. The original title was Dancer. Excellent film. And it's a stage show, apparently. I haven't seen it, but I'd love to go watch that. And in Singing in the Rain, made in 1952, there is a myth that the rain's used in the scene with Gene Kelly where he's dancing is mixed with milk to make it stand out. But can you name what actually helped it make it stand out? It was not milk. Oh, Steve, go on.
I'll just say glitter.
Incorrect. It was actually achieved by backlighting. I heard that.
I thought you were going to say cheese. I thought you were going to say cheese then. For
cheese. Just Parmesan falling from the sky.
Oh, I'd dance in that.
The next day, that set would not have smelled good.
No, it would not.
Oh, nor if they used milk. Oh, my goodness.
And the final in these very obtuse questions about dance films, the 2019 film The White Crow about the dancer Rudolf Nureyev was directed by what British actor slash, it's his third film as a director?
Brian.
Ralph
Fiennes.
Yes, correct. And with that, Brian has taken the quiz for the win.
Smoked us.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you.
The prize, honor. Brian, the prize, Brian, is that you get to plug first. So what do you have to plug?
Just my website, deepfocusreview.com. I write probably one or two new release titles a week, and once a month I do sort of a scholarly deep dive or semi-scholarly dive, an older movie, The Red Shoes before, a lot of other Paul and Pressburger movies. I also have a Patreon where people can sign up and mission reviews, basically, depending on what tier you're at, and vote in polls where they decide what I'm going to be reviewing each week. So it's a pretty involved community that's shaping how the content that's actually on the public website.
Very nice. Thank you. Steven, what have you got to promote?
Oh, so self-serving, isn't it? Right,
yes.
Two things. One is, obviously, I'm here from representing the Asian Cinema Film Club. We do a bi-weekly podcast around Asian cinema. Me and Elwood come from slightly different places. We're not very far apart geographically, but different places in terms of our cinema likings. He likes a bit of cult and weird stuff, and I'm a little bit more criterion, shall we say. He calls me art house, but I reject that label. But basically, we bring a film every other week. We take turns. We talk about it, and we're trying to get the other to love it. The other thing I just wanted to pimp was I also produce a podcast rather than really appear on it for a called In Their Own League, a website, InTheirOwnLeague.com, which is a bunch. It's basically about women in cinema, not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera. It's run by a bunch of really clever and smart ladies that I'm really happy to support just by doing some of the technical stuff and the editing behind the scenes. So please go and have a look at the website. But please listen to that podcast because it's a voice that needs listening to.
Stephen, if you can send me a link for that, I'll put it in the show notes.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Todd, I'm sure you've got something to promote.
Well, yeah, of course, the website Forgotten Films is at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. The most recent episode of the Forgotten Filmcast is still our episode on Original Gangstas with Jeanette Ward. There will be an episode probably about the same time this episode hits, popping up with Tony, where we talked about an animated film from back in the 60s called Gay Paris, featuring the voice of Judy Garland in the lead part. New episode of Walt Sent Me will be coming shortly as well. I think we're recording that tonight, all about Pixar's Soul, their newest release on Disney Plus. And then, of course, I'll promote my non-movie site, all about cool things here in the Denver area where I live. It's just me going out taking pictures of cool stuff. So that's in and around Denver, iadenver.blogspot.com.
All right. Lisa, what have you got to promote?
I would like to promote the Critical Critics movie website. We are a group of people who do a number of different reviews. There are some lists that pop up now and then. I show up maybe about like once a month or so with my reviews, simply because there are only so many movies to review, and there are a number of critical movie critics. But the other people write fantastic reviews as well, so you should support them and me, please, at thecriticalmoviecritics.com.
Meg, you've got something, I hope.
Yeah, well, I do my film-based illustrations that you can see at my website, meganhyland.com, or on my Instagram, at meghyland. Or you can look at Megan's Movie Alphabet on Instagram, which was my original movie blog on Tumblr that I am slowly moving over onto Instagram, because it revolves around me taking a film, taking the first letter of that film, and making a poster using things from the film, using just one.
Well, I look forward to perusing all illustrations and finding you on Instagram. That's what I need to do. I myself to promote. Just last week's an upcoming episode of the MILFcast. When it gets posted, I'll make sure everybody knows about it. Everybody today, it's been a pleasure to listen to people talking about a classic film. So, Brian, thank you for being with us. Stephen, Todd, Lisa, Meg, it's been very nice. And I hope to hear from you all again soon. Thanks, everybody.
How are my hosting capabilities?
Very good.
I think you did
very
a great
good.
Job.
Well done.
It's always an easy job when people are enthusiastic about talking about the film, you know. And I think once people get going, it's easy to somebody else has a comment, and the next thing you know, you've covered something that you had on your checklist, and you say, "Well, I don't need to make a special effort on that because we already talked about it."
Exactly. I'm so happy that like everyone literally just like touched on all the points that I wanted to make about it. Oh, my God.
Meg, are you a dancer yourself?
Not at all. No, I did school stuff. Like, we did, like, a school musical, and I danced in that. But, like, I am two left feet most of the time. Mm-hmm. But I just really love the whole backstage drama of this movie. And I really recently watched All That Jazz for the first time. And, like, that's another great one about, like, backstage and just kind of, like, the show.
Yes.
That should be on somebody's movie of the month list. Dang it.
I watched that for the first time last year.
It's so good.
Well, this gave me an opportunity to break into the Criterion Blu-ray that I bought 4 years ago when they have those summer sales at Barnes & Noble, and the Criterions are 50% off. And I picked up the Red Shoes. I said, oh, I'd love to have this. You know, I haven't seen it in forever. And then it sat on the shelf for, like I said, 4 years. And I said, came up, I said, oh, I'm set. I don't have to look for it anyplace. It's right there. So it's great.
HBO Max coming through on that one.
Physical media for the win.
Yes, there you go.
Does anybody subscribe? There is a Criterion collection streaming service, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
It's not available over the pond. I think it's only available in the States, is it?
Oh.
Right, it's a great channel, though. I mean, they have thousands of movies on there, and, you know, everything's great, you know. It's the same problem with Netflix now. where you have trouble making a choice, but at least you don't have to.
At least you have choices.
Does the Criterion service, though, have a watch anything Netflix roulette button? That is now, like,
it wouldn't surprise me.
Have you seen this yet?
Yes.
No.
I haven't
Is that on Netflix?
Yes.
It's on Netflix, so it depends. I landed on it because I've got a Fire TV in one room, and I went to go watch Netflix, and underneath the icons where you log in with your particular, you know, account, it said, play something, and I went, what is this? And I pressed it, and it just started playing The Crown, and I went, cool, I guess I'm watching The Crown now. But I guess it's in the, if you, like, swipe left or whatever, like, if you go into it through a different app, it'll be under where, like, search and browse and that sort of stuff is. It just says play something. And based on things that you've rated or things that you watched, it will just give you something and start playing it.
Amazing.
See, what I will do sometimes is I've got, you know, my watch list on Just Watch, which I can do all the services on. And so then I'll pick show my watch list, and I'll pick random. So it orders it randomly, and I go, okay, what comes up? Okay, yeah, sure, I'll watch that one, you know.
Do you do that on your computer, or do you do that on, like, a television?
It's a website, and they've also got an app, so I can do it on my computer or on my phone, you know.
Because I do use it, but I don't have it on, like, the Apple TV or something where it can just start playing.
It doesn't start playing it. It just, you know, takes one of my picks, you know, and moves it to the front of the list randomly, you know. So it's like,
all right, here's how the physical media guy does it. I go across my shelf, and I pull the DVD or Blu-ray out slightly from everything else, and I pick out 10 things that I've pulled out, and then my daughter, who is usually watching with me, goes through the 10 things that I've picked out, and she pushes back everything that she doesn't want to see, and whatever's left, that's what we end up watching.
That's a good system.
I actually have a similar system where I have movies that I haven't watched like I haven't watched the Blu-ray yet. I've maybe seen the movie. I just haven't watched the actual disc yet. All pulled out, and my wife and I will stand here in front of our collection and look at only the pulled out, you know, discs and decide what we're going to watch that night.
And it's still agonizing, so though, isn't it?
Yeah, we were doing that last night and couldn't decide what kind of mood we were in. And
every choice is a rejection of something else, and you hate that because you don't want to exclude those other things. You say, "Oh, I want to do that too," but we do sometimes have to choose.
Yeah, our list is like we've got a big Google sheet or Google Doc that's just like all the movies that we've heard of but we haven't watched yet, and then sometimes it comes down to, have we got a 90-minute movie, or is it are we in the mood for a 120 movie plus? And like it kind of then it goes by genre.
Yeah, Heaven's Gate is never going to be on that list.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell! Go to hell.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.